You're listening to The Rights of Civilians, a special project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. In 1993, the UN Security Council established the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It met in The Hague at a former insurance company building. It covered crimes at the direction of Slobodan Milosevic, sometimes called the Butcher of the Balkans. In the course of more than a dozen years, over 150 defendants were indicted. One was Dusko Tadic, a Bosnian Serb and a local hoodlum. His trial involved 125 witnesses. Presiding was Gabriel Kirk McDonald, an American federal judge. Tadic was convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for grotesque war crimes. Judge McDonald.
On the 7th of May, 1997, the trial chamber rendered its opinion and judgment, unanimously finding you guilty of serious violations of international humanitarian law. The chamber found that on 10 separate occasions, you beat, stabbed, and kicked 19 Muslim men in Kozarats, the Priador barracks, and the Ormazka and Karaturm camps, and you aided and abetted in the beating of one Muslim prisoner and the sexual mutilation of another at the Ormazka camp. Further, the trial chamber found that you killed two Muslim men in Kozarats by slitting their throats. You played an active part in the attack on Kozarats, its violent ethnic cleansing, and the forced expulsion of villagers from Sivski and Yashichki. You committed these offenses intentionally and with sadistic brutality. Why?
About 4 years after Tadic was sentenced, Slobodan Milosevic was arrested by Yugoslav authorities to face a war crimes trial in The Hague. Ethnic hatreds were deliberately fanned by the leaders. Milosevic decided to serve as his own lawyer at the tribunal. When I visited the trial in late 2002, he appeared to me a man consumed by rage. Judith Armada recalled a young soldier who volunteered to testify about events when he was 20 years old.
He was ordered with some of his, maybe three other soldiers, to shoot a group of people, maybe 8 or 10 of them, all civilians, women and children, and one included a baby. And he did. He shot him. And he killed the baby. And he said, he actually came forward. He called the prosecutor up and said, I want to testify. And he said, I did this. I carry this with me. I have had not one night of sleep since that happened. I always hear that baby screaming. And, you know, and he was also able to turn to Milosevic and said, you did this. And you did this to me, and you did it to those babies. You did it to those people. And you need to be held responsible. Now, that, to me, justifies the whole process.
And was there any visible reaction by Milosevic, any recognition that he bears culpability for those actions?
None. No.
The case of Slobodan Milosevic came to a sudden end when he was found dead in his cell of an apparent heart attack at age 64. I remember watching the blue and white United Nations flag fluttering from a pole in The Hague. It was outside the courthouse where the tribunals for crimes in the former Yugoslavia and also Rwanda operated. I made my way through security to Judge McDonald's chambers.
I think it's a certain catharsis for the victim to come to court and to testify. He or she gets it off his chest.
You mean it empowers the victim?
It empowers them, but I think it emboldens them also. It allows them to go forward and lead their life in a better way because they feel like and again, it's my opinion, they feel like that they're part of a system that responds to crimes not by committing more crimes, not by meting out vengeance, but by the application of the rule of law. So I think that encourages them to go back, perhaps, to their own community and say, you know what? Maybe there's another way. I was part of this process, and I was able to look the accused in the eye and say to the accused and say to the judges what had transpired. And maybe that is something that's transferred, and it's you don't just lose it when you leave the courtroom.
There must have been times when it was extremely difficult and uncomfortable for you to sit on that bench.
Of course.
And listen to the testimony about these atrocities committed in the Balkans in the 1990s.
Sure, it was. But I was a judge before, and you have to have patience, I think. That's the first thing that most judges have to have, is patience. You have to have something that is short of detachment, I think. I don't want to think that I detached totally from what happens to my fellow human beings. And I say my fellow human beings to Americans who may think that people in the former, what's going on in the former Yugoslavia or in Rwanda has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with us. I felt it.
Were there times when you could just not believe?
Of course.
That human beings can sink to such depths?
Yeah. Or you read statements. When I've confirmed so many indictments, I can't believe it. I can't even imagine where people get the idea. When you listen to a woman who has lost 35 members of her family and who's shown pictures by the prosecution, who is this? This is my uncle, this is my brother, this is my husband. Of course it touches you, but as a trained judge, you have to understand that you have to listen to the testimony, comprehend the testimony, listen for any objections that lawyers might have, and think about how you're going to rule on those objections. And at the same time, and this is very important, be patient. Hold off making any determination until all of the evidence is in, because of the presumption of innocence.
When the World War II tribunals in Nuremberg and Tokyo completed their prosecutions, many observers felt this left a legal void. If new war crimes were committed, temporary courts would have to be started from scratch, which was the case with the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. This provided little continuity or institutional stability. So for decades, a determined band of human rights advocates pressed for creation of a permanent tribunal to prosecute the worst crimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to declare open this United Nations Diplomatic Conference on the Establishment of the International Criminal Court. I invite the participants to observe 1 minute of silence for prayer or meditation.
Rome, Italy, July 1998. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan attended a gathering of nations where the treaty for the new court was formally adopted.
People all over the world want to know that humanity can strike back, that whatever and whenever genocide, war crimes, or other such violations are committed, there is a court before which the criminal can be held to account, a court that puts an end to a global culture of impunity, a court where all individuals in a government hierarchy or military hierarchy, without exception, from rulers to private soldiers, must answer for their actions.
The Rome Treaty envisioned a human rights court system that would operate in The Hague with judges and prosecutors appointed from around the world. But the court would have jurisdiction over only nations that ratify the treaty. When the required minimum of ratifications was reached in 2002, the International Criminal Court came into effect.
A page in the history of humankind is being turned.
I think it was a hugely momentous moment. I think it was a a milestone in every sense of the word in international law.
Barbara Crosette was UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
It was something that most people thought over 50 years who pressed for this just had almost assumed it would never happen or it would take a whole lot longer. So it was a tremendously important moment.
Since the court was founded, the number of participating countries has doubled. Today, 124 nations are states parties, from Afghanistan to Zambia. They include all of Europe, the United Kingdom, all of South America, Australia, Canada, much of Africa. Notably, though, many powerful nations, including the United States, Russia, China, and Israel, have thus far declined to ratify the ICC treaty. But many human rights advocates regard getting the court established as an important first step.
It's incredible to see the labors of all of us come to fruition like this. And this is an institution that is much needed, that the world has waited for very long. And we are very happy that the court is finally coming into existence.
Vahida Nainar from India was active in a coalition of women's legal groups that lobbied for the new court to include sexual violence committed during war in its lengthy, terrible list of punishable crimes. Ending the age of impunity was a watershed moment for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
Those who commit crimes, war crimes, genocide, or other crimes against humanity will no longer be beyond the reach of justice. Humanity will be able to defend itself, responding to the worst of human nature with one of the greatest achievements, the rule of law.
We're exploring international humanitarian law, which is intended to protect innocent people who become victims of military attacks. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, The Rights of Civilians, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. Can you describe how the rules of the International Criminal Court relate to the situation in Gaza right now? And who would have jurisdiction to indict Hamas and to indict Israeli officials?
The International Criminal Court's jurisdiction can be triggered in one of three ways.
Tom Dannenbaum teaches international law at Tufts University.
The first is that the crimes in question were perpetrated by the nationals of a state that has either ratified the ICC statute or otherwise consented to its jurisdiction. That, in this case, would apply to all Palestinian nationals because Palestine ratified the ICC statute in 2015. The second is when the crimes in question occurred on the territory of a state that has ratified the ICC statute or has otherwise accepted ICC jurisdiction, and there, any crimes on the territory of Palestine, which the International Criminal Court has determined includes the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, any crimes on that territory would be within ICC jurisdiction, regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator. So any Israeli crimes on the territory of Palestine, including Gaza, would be covered by ICC jurisdiction. The third possibility is that the UN Security Council refers a situation to the International Criminal Court, in which case you don't need the consent of the territorial state or the state of nationality. That's obviously not going to happen in this particular context, but it doesn't matter.
Why is it obviously not going to happen?
Well, because the United States would clearly veto any referral of this situation to the International Criminal Court, given its alliance with Israel. But it doesn't matter in this particular context because all of the crimes that we're looking at have either occurred on the territory of Palestine, specifically Gaza or the West Bank, or have been perpetrated by Palestinian nationals, such as the attacks in Israel on October 7th, but that were perpetrated by Palestinian nationals. And since either of those is a sufficient ground for jurisdiction, the ICC has jurisdiction in both directions.
So is it reasonable to assume that the legal liability applies on both sides?
Yes, the legal liability applies on both sides. The Israeli argument against jurisdiction is that Palestine is not a state under international law. However, 140 states in the international system have recognized Palestinian statehood. And importantly, the International Criminal Court, when asked about the scope of its jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine by the ICC prosecutor, determined in 2021 that it did have jurisdiction because Palestine had validly ratified the ICC statute and therefore constituted a state party to the ICC, regardless of the underlying question of its statehood.
Are you confident that the ICC will bring an indictment against Hamas and Israel in this case?
I think it's very likely that there will ultimately be arrest warrants on both sides in this conflict. I would expect the first arrest warrants to be for hostage taking on the Hamas side and for starvation of civilians as a method of warfare on the Israeli side, because those crimes are, in my view, fairly clearly implicated, and the implication goes all the way to the top of both of those entities, the Israeli state and Hamas as an organization. And so I think it is very likely that there will be arrest warrants on both sides. And I think arrest warrants are justified on both sides, so I don't think that would be an abuse of discretion on the part of the prosecutor. I think it would be a sensible reaction to a situation that involves significant criminality in both directions. I do think that it's unlikely that they will sequence these, so I think they will try to bring arrest warrants on both sides at a fairly proximate time to one another. That probably is driven more by the politics than anything else.
If indicted, is there immediate impact on a defendant's ability to travel to territories that are bound to enforce the International Criminal Court Treaty?
Yes. There are 124 states globally that are party to the ICC statute. If an arrest warrant is issued, all of those states have a clear obligation under the ICC framework to effectuate that arrest warrant, to arrest an individual who comes within their jurisdictional control who is listed on that arrest warrant.
So, for example, if Netanyahu were indicted and wanted to travel to Canada, which is a state party, the Canadian government would be required to take him into custody and turn him over to the ICC?
Correct. But there are domestic legal structures in many states that can be mobilized to domesticate that international arrest warrant. And what that means is it can actually be moved out of the hands of the political leaders within that state because it becomes a valid domestic arrest warrant. And here it's perhaps worth drawing an analogy again with the situation in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin is one of the most powerful heads of state globally. South Africa, a state party to the International Criminal Court, clearly did not want to arrest him and did want him to be able to visit the BRICS summit at the moment that the arrest warrant was issued. And a court in Pretoria determined that there was an obligation to domesticate the ICC arrest warrant. And at that point, the government of South Africa realized that it was going to face a constitutional crisis if Vladimir Putin arrived in South Africa, because there was now this valid arrest warrant and it would require a political intervention into a process of justice to block that arrest warrant being effectuated. And the solution was to have Vladimir Putin not come to the BRICS summit. If that can happen to Vladimir Putin, clearly it can happen to Netanyahu. He does not have the same level of global power, and significantly, more of Netanyahu's, or specifically Israel's, allies and states friendly to Israel are party to the International Criminal Court than are allies of Russia. And so, in a sense, Netanyahu's world would shrink even more than has Vladimir Putin's.
Yet although Putin was indicted by the court, he has remained at large. obtaining custody of an ICC defendant has proved possible in some cases, but in others remains a major stumbling block. Many obstacles have been erected to blunt the court's effectiveness. Some have said the ICC is often toothless. Tom Dannenbaum.
Well, it certainly is not a structure with automaticity in its enforcement. So what it can do is issue an arrest warrant. The individual in question faces a significant risk if they travel to an ICC state party. They are, to a certain extent, rendered a pariah on the international stage, and the arrest warrant endures in perpetuity. There are no statute of limitations for these crimes, and so there's no point that an individual who's the subject of an ICC arrest warrant can view in the future as the point at which this risk to them will expire. And so, given that no individual knows how long they're going to hold on to that political power, and they cannot predict the trajectory of the politics within the state in which they're operating, it is not a meaningless reality that they are now the subject of an arrest warrant. And if you look at past international criminal prosecutions, at the time that the crimes were occurring, it would have seemed inconceivable or extremely ambitious or optimistic to think that the perpetrators of those crimes would be brought to justice. But if we think about the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, for example, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia did gain custody over Slobodan Milosevic, did begin a trial against him. He died in custody, so that trial wasn't taken to completion. But they did try and convict Radovan Karadzic, the leader of Republika Srpska, the breakaway Bosnian Serb regime in Bosnia, and Ratko Mladic, the head military actor within Republika Srpska. The Special Court for Sierra Leone tried and convicted Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, for his role in supporting the Revolutionary United Front in Sierra Leone. And we can look at the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia, which decades after the killing fields in Cambodia tried and convicted Nguyen Chia, who was brother number two, Pol Pot's deputy in the context of the killing fields in Cambodia. So this can be a slow process. It's not a process that's guaranteed to succeed, but it is a process that has a basis in law, that has immediate effects in terms of its travel implications, and where there are no statutes of limitations, and so we can't predict where this will ultimately end up.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart-Rose. Editorial assistance from Kathy Graham and Ken Rogers. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Steve Martin, Steve Colby, and Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media.
To download an audio copy of this program and access other resources, please visit humanmedia.org. That's humanmedia.org. You can also access our other programs and send us an email from our website. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast, Humankind, on Public Radio. This segment, part of our project, The Rights of Civilians, is Humankind program number 290.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.